Hello Playmates, welcome to Radio Dalect. We're coming to you from the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads in Bristol. In today's show, we are delighted to welcome Lawrence Hu, the poet, who is here to talk about his career and his new book. We have our usual archives locked away. We delve into the museum's vast library of Commonwealth audio archives and a poem from Dalect's Kristen Powers. There are the regular features from reporter Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Jeff Sparks will bring you the latest in What's On, and I am John Peters Coleman, presenting the show. So it's now over to actually myself for the news. An internal Home Office report released recently has shown the true scale of Britain's illicit drug economy. It is estimated there are 300 major importers, 3,000 wholesalers and 70,000 street dealers with a turnover of between £7 and £8 billion a year. The average dealer has a turnover of £100k a year and employs salaried staff such as runners and storers. With Christmas approaching, the demand for heroin could drive the price up to £1,000 a kilo. The report, The Illicit Drug Trade in the United Kingdom, was carried out by Matrix Knowledge Group and the London School of Economics. It is the first large-scale interview programme with drug traffickers and dealers in prison. The study says the demand for drugs remain high and stable, with a tendency for dealers in heroin and cocaine to specialise. More than three-quarters of dealers begin their activities through family or friends and had a willingness to break the law. According to the report, dealers are very careful who they work with, choosing only people they grew up with or people they spent time inside prison with. One dealer had unwittingly married a police informant who turned him in. She had previously been married to two other drug dealers who were also caught. An electronic stimulator to relieve pain has been patented by Bristol-based pain researcher Dr. Alex MacDonald and physiologist Dr. Timothy Coates. The invention, named Articare, is a drug-free therapy that provides symptomatic relief from types of pain. Many users have been impressed by its effectiveness. In a survey carried out on the device, 72% of replies to 324 questioned found that their pain levels have been reduced by a half. The handheld device releases a powerful, high-voltage and very high-frequency electronic pulse, which penetrates deep into the tissues but causes only a mild tingling sensation. Articare adhesive electrodes are placed at the top and bottom of the spine for pain associated with legs, hips and back, or placed either side of the neck for problems with shoulders, neck and head. This means the device can treat multiple pains simultaneously rather than one pain at a time. Inventor Tim Coates said the drug-free device was safe to use in the home without any adverse effect on medication. Of the 5,000 patients monitored using Articare, none suffered from adverse side effects. However, home users are warned that Articare is safe to use in home, but should not be used to treat undiagnosed pains, as it could mask the root of a serious medical problem. Passengers in the southeast are avoiding congested London airports and choosing to fly from regional airports. A study by Civil Aviation Authority claimed that the growth in regional airports had outstripped that of Stansted, Gatwick and Heathrow since the start of the decade. Passengers using regional airports rose to 7% compared to London airports, which averaged 3% between 2000 and 2006. The report said there was anecdotal evidence that various factors had led to an increased popularity in regional airports. These included the reputation that Heathrow has for overcrowding and poor service, exacerbated by last summer's terror scare. Airline companies have started to use regional airports for international flights, direct to New York and the Arab Emirates, and Heathrow has seen a sharp decline in domestic flights due to the increased cost carriers. The fastest growing regional airport is Bristol, followed by Liverpool, East Midlands, Leeds, Bradford, Prestwick and Southampton. And last but not least, Bristol saxophonist Andy Shepherd has been listed in the Volume 4 1000 Albums to Hear Before You Die section of the Guardian newspaper on November the 21st. The album Dancing Man and Woman was released in 1999. The newspaper describes Andy Shepherd as a saxophonist who emerged in the late 80s to become one of the quirkiest, subtle, inventive and sought-after musicians. This lyrical set reflects his fondness for massaging understated story-like pieces with an augmented band including legendary American electric bassist Steve Swallow and tabla player Kaljit Bamra.
Dialect is a community project run by volunteers. and we need you. If you'd like to get involved, check out our website at radiodialect.net.
Approximately 3,300 children a year are placed for adoption, and the rate is steadily increasing. The government has asked for a 40% increase in adoption, and through public service agreements, some councils are fully meeting this and gaining massive financial rewards and stars for doing so. Kent County Council received £2 million for meeting 10 out of 12 targets for the years 2000-2003. This has strongly motivated social workers to procure children suitable for adoption, even if it means splitting up the families they are meant to support and protect. Often cases are heard in secret in the family courts behind closed doors. Dialect's reporter Lisa Braden interviewed protesters about the adoption issue, and here is her report.
I'm with Ian Walton in Broad Street in town. Could you tell me about what's going on today?
We're actually protesting about the injustice in the family courts and about the secrecy and about everything that's being done behind closed doors. They're actually imprisoning families without a trial, without a judge, without a jury, and we're looking to have the similar proceedings in family courts as what they do in the criminal court.
How can that happen?
Well, I mean, they use the argument that the children need their privacy and secrecy, but they're actually hiding what really goes on. They have adoption targets, which Tony Blair increased to 40%, which was supposed to mean for children already in care. But children already in care are actually over the age of 7, and they're not adoptable material. Newborn babies are more adoptable.
How did you find out about this?
How did I find out about this? Through my own experiences with the system and through the organisation that I've actually put up myself. I have a lot of people phone me up and ask me for advice.
What do you actually do? What's
the organisation is called Stop Injustice Now, and we actually give advice for people that are going through we term is forced adoption, where people are actually forced to have their children adopted based on emotional abuse or possible, I use the word possible neglect, possible abuse. I can't predict the future. I mean, it's impossible to predict the future. How can you say possible emotional harm? Possible emotional abuse, that's what they blame it on.
How long have you been going?
I've been going like 8 years. This organisation actually started in March this year, but I personally have been going 8 years myself.
Right, so you've got a petition here I can see. What are you hoping to do with this?
The petition is actually going to Downing Street. We need 100,000 signatures.
How many have you got already?
12,000.
Excellent.
We've been protesting at least once or twice a month throughout the country.
If people want to get involved or contact you, have you got any contact details, phone numbers, websites?
The website is www.stopinjusticenow.com. That's probably the easiest way. It's got all the contact details you need, from their emails to phone numbers. There's a forum which people can join that need advice immediately. There's live chat rooms as well where people can get advice from as well.
How long are you actually doing this for? Are you doing it every day, or is it just today? Or
We do 1 week in every month.
Here? Yeah.
Well, 1 month throughout. There's different... One week in every month we do in a different part of the country. We just happened to pick Bristol this week. This one, unfortunately, is the last one this year because of the weather. And
yeah, sure.
We'll start up again in the new year. We're going to do a different one every month. We're going to start, we've done like most of the country this year, and we're going to start again probably in Newcastle and work our way back down again.
Which place has been the most supportive, or has everyone been supportive?
Everywhere we go, it's exactly the same. The biggest demonstration we actually done was in Derbyshire. We had a massive turnout. There was over 50 plus people in Derbyshire. That was the biggest turnout we've had. Okay. We done Manchester, and there was a good turnout there as well. There's videos actually on the website if people want to actually see what we have been up to as well.
Okay, Ian Walton, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Lisa for that. If you feel that you've been affected by any of the issues in that report, you can log on to the main website at www.stopinjusticenow.com, and that's all one word.
Sunlight bright upon my pillow, light. footsteps catch me. Am I really dying?
That was from the Relics album by Pink Floyd, and that was Julia Dream. And now over to who is listed on my cue sheet as Tony Drugs. Hey, Tony Drugs, how you doing?
One of the most frustrating things about Bristol is its drugs problem. Rumours abound that St Paul's is one of the cheapest places in the country to score hard drugs such as heroin and crack cocaine. Most people see Class A drugs, like these, as causing the biggest problems in the city. Through these drug users' links to violent crime, robbery and burglary. But the Association of Chief Police Officers are making moves in the opposite direction. They're focusing on cannabis as the biggest problem and making moves to up cannabis's category from Class C to Class B.
My name is Steve Barker and I'm a spokesman for the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, and I also run a telephone helpline for people who get arrested for cannabis offences, called the Cannabis Legal Support Service. Originally, when cannabis was put into Class C in 2004, the police supported this because it regularised something that was happening irregularly, which was sometimes they let people off who were found in possession of cannabis, sometimes they'd arrest them, sometimes they'd give them a caution. There was no straight-through policy. This was to standardise that policy, and in the original guidelines, the police, the ACPO guidelines, they said that personal possession of cannabis would no longer be an arrestable offence, although in actual practice, most people who are found by police to be in possession of cannabis are given a caution. But a caution itself is no longer counts as an offence, so it would not count against your employment record, for example.
What other implications are there if it goes to Class B, say, for example, for people who are dealing in cannabis or growing cannabis?
Well, when they move cannabis into Class C, they up the penalties for Class C production and supply to what they were under Class B. So in a report put out by the Institute of Criminal Policy Research on policing cannabis at Class C basically said nothing very much had changed. Now, the reason that is given by the police and the people who are talking about putting it back into Class B is that they think that a lot of kids are using cannabis under the impression that it's legal. What they're not considering is that the government's own figures have shown that the use of cannabis, since it was put into Class C, has gone down by 25%. Now, in most businesses, this would be considered to be a considerable success. What we're saying is that some kids were actually taking cannabis because it was illegal, and we would predict that if they put it back into Class C, use amongst young people is going to go up because they see it as a blow against the empire. Some people say that the police are actually chasing arrest targets and conviction targets, and if they recriminalise cannabis, this means they get better figures.
So what you're saying is the more things that the police can criminalise, the better their figures at the end of the year, the more arrests, and they're getting these kind of targets up.
I don't blame the police for this, but this is a way that policing is going. They're not actually looking at solving social problems. They are actually looking at getting figures up. So what this means is that not just cannabis, but all drugs convictions, they become like currency within the criminal justice industry. And, of course, a lot of people make money out of drug convictions, the solicitors, the police, the private prison industry.
There is another side to all this, of course, and that is one of the most controversial things here in Bristol, in the inner city, is that there are parts of the inner city where there is hard drug dealing going on of heroin and crack cocaine. And many people drive past these places day after day and they see deals going on in the street, and yet the police don't act. Now, the reason for that, the police tell us, is that they want to keep paid informers to be informing the police on these places rather than closing them down.
There was a lady, an elderly lady in the north of England who was arrested, a medical cannabis user, who actually went into the police station, spoke to a senior police officer and says, why are you paying money to hard drug dealers to report medical cannabis users and allowing them continue to operate? And the police officer said, cannabis dealers don't give us the information we want. This is followed up by another letter from a representative of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance to Vic Hogg, who is a senior representative of the Home Office, who looked into this, and he came back and said, the police said that this is procedure, this is policy.
So it's actual policy, because the police aren't getting, what they say is, enough information from cannabis users about who's using drugs and who's dealing drugs, that they're actually keeping these illegal crack dens and heroin dealing areas open in order to get information. But what about the ethics of that?
Well, there's a case of two brothers who were brought into the country, I can't remember their names offhand, from Turkey, on the basis of the fact that they were supposed to be giving information to the intelligence services who are responsible for monitoring drug importation. They were brought into the country. They wound up being the biggest hard drug dealers and biggest heroin dealers in the country. They're both now in prison, one in Holland and one in this country. So this was done with government money. The situation is that the police are actually being drawn into turf wars. There's no doubt about this at all. The smart dealers who know who to pay off in the police and how to get bent results are actually operating with impunity and in exchange for selling the names and addresses of their clients to the police.
But if they're selling the names and addresses of their clients to the police, surely those clients are going to be being arrested, and they're knocking down their client base. You know, it seems very strange to allow a dealer to continue to operate just so long as he supplies you names and addresses, because he's going to surely eventually run out of people to be selling drugs to.
Well, you're now talking about demand and supply and market forces within the illegal drug world. I wouldn't like to comment on their marketing policy, but they obviously take that into account.
Is there any way you think that local people can campaign for hard drug dens to be closed down whilst the police are still paying informers to sort of keep an information flow going?
Well, there's a lot of people involved in the campaign to legalise cannabis who are former hard drug users who have found that use of cannabis has actually helped them to stay off hard drugs, stay off alcohol, and in some cases give up tobacco smoking. So the issue is, what are the effects of social cannabis use? Well, cannabis users, on the whole, are non-violent. Cannabis is not addictive, and it doesn't have any serious health problems. When you consider there are different ways you can take cannabis, you can take it in food, you can smoke it through a sort of inhaler that turns it into vapor, you can smoke it through a bong that takes out some of the toxics, water, smoker. There's various different ways you can take cannabis, and most cannabis users are recreational ones. There's a lot of people in the country who use cannabis for medical reasons. They suffer depression or they suffer physical pain, and they are using it to reduce the symptoms of those things. So actually, cannabis use is actually saving the government and the health service money. But of course, we're not getting this argument.
Steve Barker there, who's the spokesman for the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, who run a drugs helpline, talking to me about proposals from the Association of Chief Police Officers to upgrade cannabis from a Class C drug to a Class B drug, and giving us an insight into how the police's use of paid informers keeps crack and heroin dealers in business.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net. Radiodialect.net.
radiodialect.net.
Thank you to Tony Gosling for that feature. It's time now for our weekly dip into the oral history vaults of the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum here at Temple Meads. Enjoy it while it's here. This time we're off to Palestine again during the Second World War, where our interviewee is Sir Gawain Westrebell, a military man, KCMG CBE, author of the book Shadows in the Sand. This week we hear about the second half of World War II and Bell's attempts to calm down the situation between the Jews and the Arabs, who were both fighting British rule in Palestine at the start of the World War II.
How did this get resolved in the end?
Palestine,
that particular situation.
Well, if you read the history of that period, there were attempt after attempt to come to a settlement. They had roundtable conferences in London. They called in other Arab countries to act as mediators and try and help. And in the end, it must have been in May of 1939, the British government produced a solution and published a white paper in which they said, all right, we'll put an end to Jewish immigration to this extent that it will run for 5 years, that 50,000 immigrants will be allowed in every year, plus 25,000 as a particular concession towards those who are being driven out of Germany and so on. And at the end of that time, there will be established in Palestine, because by that time there was a majority of Arabs, easily. At that time, there will be formed a government of some sort, which of course will have an Arab majority, and they will decide whether there will be any further immigration. Now, the Arabs would be very wise to accept this suggestion by the British government, or this recommendation by the British government. Unfortunately, they didn't do so. Not that history would have been all that different, I dare say. But I think if they'd done so, they would have shown that they really did want to cooperate in the solution of a problem which appeared to be insoluble. But unfortunately, they didn't. The Arabs of Palestine rejected it, and Arabs of other states, although I think some of them thought that it was quite a good solution, they didn't. They didn't come out in favour of it openly. What happened then was that the war started. By this time, the British army had in fact got the better of the gangs, and there was very little lawlessness to the extent that roads were mined or bridges were blown up or trains were derailed or anything of that sort. By the time of September 1939, when the war began, Arab resistance to government control had really faded away. They were beaten in this contest. And they then said, all right, we won't resist you anymore so long as the war is on. This is remarkable, really, despite, in view of the fact that the Germans have been putting out propaganda and the Italians have been putting out propaganda and over their Arab broadcasts, where the British government was constantly being denigrated in every possible way. They did, and the rebellion, to all intents and purposes, ceased. And then, as you know, the war came. During the war, the Jews were busy arming themselves secretly in the Jewish colonies, so that at the end of the war they said to themselves, we shall have a problem on our hands. We're determined this country shall become Israel. But they ostensibly sided with the British government, they volunteered for the armed forces and so forth, so did the Arabs for that matter. I mean, the Holy Arab Legion was entirely Arab. But the Palestine problem broke out again, immediately after the war, when the Jews said, fine, we've had the measure of Hitler, Hitler's destroyed, and now we can get on with the business of turning Palestine into Israel. And so then the boot was on the other foot, and the British government was busy dealing with the Jews and not the Arabs. And you can remember all those incidents that happened then.
And of course, it's a situation that's never been very satisfactorily resolved anyway, is it?
No, really? Not to this day, good gracious me.
What happened to you when war broke out?
When war broke out, I was in Beersheba. And I had recently gone to Beersheba. Beersheba, as I told you earlier on, had been occupied by the Arab gangs. They'd burnt the offices, they'd destroyed all the police posts, which were manned by Arabs, by the Camel Corps, and they had even destroyed all the dispensaries and smashed all the bottles of medicine. So there was nothing, there was no administration in southern Palestine at all. And McMichael, who was the High Commissioner, sent for me and he said, I'm going to give you a new job. I was in Tiberias at the time. He said, I want you to become partly a policeman. You've had some experience of police work in the Sudan. I want you to go to Beersheba, re-establish the camel gendarmerie, which had fled. They'd all gone off, took their camels and their rifles with them and disappeared into the desert. Re-establish that force and make contact with the sheikhs all over southern Palestine. And he said, I want a man who knows one end of a camel from another, and I want a man who can talk to these Bedouin sheikhs, gentleman to gentleman, somebody who's got Sudan ideas. And that was a most marvelous assignment which had been given. I packed my bags in Tiberias and hurried down to Beersheba with the greatest delight. Beersheba was a wonderful place again for a young British chap. The army had reoccupied the place and they were just rebuilding the government offices. And the old railway station had been destroyed. But I had two jobs to do, really. One was to re-establish this camel gendarmerie, which consisted of 100 men mounted on camels. And the other, and I did that with the help of the Palestine police, of course, and the other one was to make contact with local sheikhs and to say, you know, the battle's finished now. Let's get back to administration as we knew it. And as part of that business, of course, was the re-establishment of the police posts, which had all been destroyed in various parts of southern Palestine, Beersheba district.
Sir Gawain Westrebel, KCMGCBE, there in an interview recorded in 1995, explaining his part in reinstating a part British, part Palestinian police force at the end of World War II. A job which involved a lot of travelling, partly by car and partly on the back of a camel.
After his second wife passed away, Percy Rawlinson seemed to spend more and more time with his Alsatian Al. His friends told him, you should get up more, Percy, you'll wind up looking like a dog, ha ha. He was later arrested near a lamppost. At his trial some months later, he surprised everyone by mistaking a policeman for a postman and tearing his trousers off with his bare teeth. In his defence, he told the court, it's hard to tell the difference when they take their hats off. Betty Pench was playing the trombone when she heard a knock on the door. I wonder who that is at 11 o'clock in the morning, she thought. But cautiously opening the door instead of the turbaned ruffian she expected, she found a very nice young man. Mrs. Pench, you've won the car contest. Would you like a Triumph Spitfire or 3,000 in cash? She smiled. Mrs. Pench took the money. What will you do with it all? Not that it's any of my business, he giggled. I think I'll become an alcoholic, said Betty. With a geranium behind each ear and his face painted with gay cabalistic symbols, 6'8", 17 stone police sergeant Jeff Bull looked jolly convincing as he sweated and grunted through a vigorous twist routine at the Fraga Go-Go beer keller. His hot serge trousers flapped wildly over his enormous plastic sandals as he jumped and jumped and gyrated towards a long-haired man.
Excuse me, man, I reason to believe you can turn me on.
He leered suggestively. As if by magic, dozens of truncheons appeared and mercilessly thrashed him. Poor Jeff, what a turnout for the books. Much as he hated arguments or any kind of unpleasantness, Ron Shirt thought things had gone too far when, returning from a weekend in Clacton, he found that his neighbour had trimmed the enormous hedge dividing their gardens into the shape of a human leg. Enraged and envious beyond belief, Ron seized his garden shears and clipped his white poodle Leo into a coffee table. That'll fix it, thought Ron, but he was wrong. The following Wednesday, his neighbour had his bushy waist-length hair cut and permed into a model of the Queen Elizabeth and went sailing. Everywhere he went, people said, hooray! Sometimes you just can't win.
Ooh, sudden ending, I love it. That's Rhinocratic Oaths by Bonzo Doug Doodah Band.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check out our website on radiodialect.net.
The son of the writer, J.B. Priestley, has this month donated 50 of his unpublished letters to his father, stepmother and sister, written from the trenches in the First World War. The 47 letters and 3 postcards have been donated to Bradford University by Tom Priestley, an author and filmmaker. J.B. Priestley, who originated from Bradford, gives a brief but vivid description of life on the front, in particularly in the notorious Vimy Ridge, where he was posted in 1916. He describes the scene thus: "You must have heard of the famous labyrinth. Well, this is it. Great hills half blown away, old trenches full of heads, legs and arms, blood-stained clothing and old equipment." J.B. Priestley survived the war, but he never wrote about his experiences in his prodigious output of novels and plays. His anger at the bungled generalship and the waste of hundreds of thousands of young lives silenced him on the subject. The letters are being archived by Alison Cullingford, librarian of the Special Collections in Bradford. She has just published an account of Priestley's war service in a book, Bradford in the Great War. All his life, when Priestley thought about his school days, he saw instead a crowd of ghosts. Our intrepid reporter Anthony Page recently interviewed Rita Brown, who was born in Bradford in 1925, about her recollections of a father who survived the fighting and came home from the Great War.
And I'm going to talk about my father.
And can you tell us, Rita, what happened when your father came back from the First World War?
When my father first came back from the First World War, I can only remember from the age of about 4, woken up another image in coming to this, because I remember my granny's funeral, and the horses were all in black plumes and things on their hooves, and I remember seeing that funeral set off. My brother and I couldn't go because I had some disease, child disease. I'm not sure it was measles or what it was, but we had to stay at home. And I remember seeing that cortege go off. And then the next image I have is of the next day, my Aunt Sally, who lived diagonally at the back of us, came out of her house, and there was a musical photograph album, and when you turned the pages it played a tune, and there was also a family Bible from the 1700s.
Oh, fantastic.
And the day after the funeral, my Aunt Sally came out of her house with these two books, the family Bible and a photograph album, and she flung them over the wall at the bottom of the yard, and they went rolling off down into the canal at the bottom.
That was something to do with your grandfather, wasn't it?
No, I think that was something to do with... I don't know what it was to do with, because my grandfather lived with his woman on the outskirts of Bradford in the country. I didn't know my grandfather. My brother used to be taken to see him, but not me. And I think my Aunt Sally did that, what I found very awful. I think she did it because of the way she was treated by her father. There was no help. She was widowed, and she'd got two sons who were in their teen years at that age, at that time. So life would be very hard for her.
Because he was quite wealthy, your grandfather, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was.
What was his mill called? Ward?
I can only see...
Is it Joseph Ward?
My grandfather was Samuel, S and J Ward, in big gilt letters on top of the mill.
Do you remember the road?
I can see the road. I don't know the name of the road, but that road we used, my mother used to take me along that road to go and see a friend of hers in Halifax, and we used to walk that distance. That's the only impression I have of that situation.
And what did they make at the mill?
They made wool.
It was a weave. Spinning.
Yes, spinning. But my grandfather was the one that devised the dyes. He used to travel. It took 4 years each trip. He used to travel to the States and places to get dyes for the wool and come back. It was 2 years there and 2 years back. As I say, I didn't know my grandfather. My brother was taken to see him, but not me.
So your brother didn't ever fancy going into the family business then?
I don't think there was any question of that, really. Not really. I don't think my mother would have... Well, I don't know what to think, because my grandfather had a housekeeper, as they call the woman that lived...
He lived with this woman?
Yes. Yes.
It was a euphemism, was it?
Pardon?
A euphemism.
That's right. But what I find strange is that my brother was taken to see him, but I wasn't. I see that as an adult. I never used to think about it as a child, but I think as an adult. And I don't think my grandfather was at my grandmother's funeral either. In fact, I'm sure he wasn't. So he wasn't really a very nice person, really. I've lost track now.
But we were going to talk about your father.
My father.
Being in the First World War, because it affected him very...
It did.
...badly, didn't it, when he came home?
He wasn't able to take any responsibility for everything. My mother sorted out the finances and the whole shoot. My father, when I was about four, I remember my father still wasn't working, hadn't got the, not carriage, but wasn't able in any case to think of a job.
What, mentally or physically?
Mentally, I think. Mm. Mentally. And across the road from where we lived, there was a cinder, a big area laid with cinders as a play area. Mm-hmm. And we used to go, my father used to take me and we'd play football on there when he first came home. And I remember at one point I trod on the ball and scraped all my nose, and that scar there is where there was a piece of cinder.
Ooh.
I remember my mother going absolutely ballistic when she came home. It was almost as if he'd let me fall, you know, and he hadn't at all. It was a pure accident. But she was very angry about it all. We didn't play football anymore. And it was not long after that that she found a job for him, where she used to buy her purses. It was a saddler's shop as well. And she got this job for my father with this little shop. And he used to be working down in the cellar. They used to do saddlery and leather goods. And he was the one that made the saddles and things. And I can remember when I was about 10, and by now we'd moved on to the outskirts of Bradford on a large estate that was built for returning soldiers from the war. And I remember I would go on a Saturday to meet my dad. I'd go walk down to where he was in this cellar with the saddlery, and I'd talk to him through the gap in the wall until it was time for him to finish, and then we'd walk home together. My dad never mentioned the war at all. I have one image of the pent-up feelings that he must have had. This was when I was about, I think, five or six, and we'd gone down. There was always a big ceremony on Armistice Day in the Town Hall Square in Bradford, and we'd all gone down. My mother wasn't there, my brother and myself, my father were there, and I remember this incident. I think I was 5 and my brother was 10, and all at once, when the chime was for 11 o'clock, my brother had forgotten to take his cap off, and my father's hand nearly knocked his head off with the cap, and the cap went into the distance, and we never got the cap back.
And that was Rita Brown talking about her father's life after the First World War.
Spent on us.
That was Light Flights by Pentangle from a very long time ago. Well, here we are in the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, and back in the day, of course, they used to describe India as the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. Well, we don't have that anymore. We have a new jewel in the crown, and it's Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide.
Well, first of all, I've got a poem to read. This is a poem by Thomas Chatterton, who was born in Bristol on November the 20th, 1753, and died 17 years later on August 23rd, 1770. In his lifetime, he wrote poetry and longed for fame and fortune. The fame came after his death, when he influenced and inspired many of the poets of the Romantic movement. What I'll be reading is Chatterton's last verses, written in August 1770. Farewell, Bristolia's dingy piles of brick, lovers of mammon, worshippers of trick. Ye spurned the boy who gave you ancient lays, and paid for learning with your empty praise. Farewell, ye guzzling aldermanic fools, by nature fitted for corruption's tools. I go to where celestial anthems swell, but you, when you depart, will sink to hell. Farewell, my mother, cease my anguished soul, nor let distraction's billows o'er me roll. Have mercy, heaven, when here I cease to live, and this last act of wretchedness forgive. And now we have the What's On Guide from Radio Dialect. Seeing as we're broadcasting in the middle of this weekend, I'll be bringing you some of the best gigs for next weekend. Let's kick things off with Thursday, 6th of December, and at the Thecla in Bristol, the Slackers will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 each. And at the Fiddlers in Wheelway Street, Bristol, Scarvale UK will be performing with support from the Communicators. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance and £8 on the door. Now I come to Song of the Week, and this week the honours go to the two-hit wonder John Otway. This track was his first hit back in 1977 when it got to number 27 in the UK singles chart, and is titled Really Free.
Well, I wake up in the morning. Tell me, baby, what do you see? I see my true love. She walks up and she kisses me. I say, poor baby, that's really free. I go walking down to your house. Tell me, baby, is it good for me? Your ma and pa, they just want to kick me. I say, poor baby, that's really free. Really free, really free, really, 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 really free, can be. I try talking to your mama. Oh no, that's not good for me. Every time I go near your baby, you say, cool, baby, that's really. With the heat on me, every time you move towards my body, I say, come on, baby, that's really free. A really free, really free, really, 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 really free, kick me. In the morning, tell me, baby, what do you see? I see my true love, and she walks up and she kisses me. I say, oh, baby, that's really free. I go walking down to your house. Tell me, baby, that's not good for me. Your ma and pa, they just want to kick me. I say, oh, baby, that's really free. A really free.
That was John Otway with Really Free. In 2002, he had his second hit, a track titled Bunsen Burner, and that got to number 9 in the UK singles chart. For more information, check out www.johnotway.com. Moving on to Friday 7th of December, and at the Fiddler's is the annual Christmas outing for the Blue Aeroplanes. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Also on Friday and at the Grain Barge in Hot Wells in Bristol, Steve Payne will be performing. The gigs should start around 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Saturday, 8th of December, and at the Colston Hall in Bristol, Thin Lizzy will be performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £24 in advance. In Gloucester, at the Guildhall on the same night, Limehouse Lizzy will be performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Finally, on a Sunday, 9th of December, at the Old Tavern in Stapleton in Bristol, the 14-piece soul, funk and jazz group Bring Down the House will be performing. That is all from me today. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. This week, Kristen Powers will read an excerpt from the diaries of Sylvia Plath, published by Faber and Faber and the Sylvia Plath Estate. Sylvia Plath, who was married to Ted Hughes, the poet laureate, suffered from depression. In 1962, when she and Ted Hughes separated, she went to live in London, renting a flat with her two children, Frieda and Nicholas, in Fitzroy Road. She took her own life on the morning of the 11th of February, 63. Plath's gravestone bears the inscription, "Even amidst fierce flames, the golden lotus can be planted."
Sunday, September 14, 1958, Boston. 2 weeks have inexplicably withered away. Yesterday we both bogged in a black depression. The late nights, listening sporadically to Beethoven piano sonatas, ruining our mornings. The afternoon sun too bright and accusing for tired eyes. Meals running off schedule. And me with my old panic fear sitting firm on my back. Who am I? What shall I do? The difficult time between years of school routine and the fear of dilatory dilettante days. The city calls. Experience and people call and must be shut out. I must be happy first in my own work and struggle to that end, so my life does not hang on Ted's. Who else in the world could I live with and love? Nobody. I picked a hard way which has to be all self-mapped out and must not nag, mention haircuts, washes, money-making plans, children. Anything Ted doesn't like, this is nagging. He, of course, can nag me about light meals, writing exercises, from his superior seat. The famed and fatal jealousy of professionals. Must work and get out of paralysis. Write and show him nothing. Novels, stories, poems. A misty, furred, gray, sunny Sunday. Do we vampire-like feed on each other? A wall, soundproof, must mount between us. Strangers in our study, lovers in bed. Monday, September 15. A panic. Absolute and obliterating. I am afraid. Of what? Life without having lived, chiefly. If I could funnel this into a novel, this fear, this horror. A frog sits on my belly. Stop and ask why you wash, why you dress. You go wild. It is as if love, pleasure, opportunity surrounded me and I were blind. I talk hysterically. Or I feel I will explode. I'm in a fix. How to get out of it? Some little daily external ritual. I'm too ingrown, as if I no longer knew how to talk to anyone but Ted.
And you can hear Kristen read a Sylvia Plath poem next week. I have one last news item. Thank you to Tony Gosling for this. The American Navy plans to blow up its own fifth fleet in the Gulf and blame it on Iran, according to the French Voltaire Network. In a plan much like the Gulf of Tonkin, incident that started the Vietnam War, the Fifth Fleet sacrifice has been discussed within the US Joint Chief of Staff Cabinet. According to the network, Admiral William Fallon, made clear that if such an order was given, he would refuse to follow it and would hand in his resignation, along with the entire CENTCOM headquarters. So far, only the Navy and Army superior officers' resistance has prevented the neoconservatives and the Air Force to launch the operation. And that's the end of our Radio Dalek show today, coming from the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads in Bristol. Apologies for the lack of Lawrence Hu. He did not appear. Perhaps we'll be able to rearrange that. But his new book is Inner City Tales, so look out for that. Our features this week were by reporters Tony Gosling and Lisa Braden, and the news was read by myself, John Peters Coleman. The Sylvia Plath diary was read by Kirsten Powers, and thank you very much to Jeff Sparks for his What's On guide. Take a bow. The new website was designed by Tim Pike. Log on to dialectradio.com, and the studio engineer was Villas Chichikurin. The show this week was produced by Anthea Page. Next week in the studio, we have some rap poets from the recent Rhymes of Resistance Festival, plus all our usual features. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I will be back next week with Lisa Braden to present the show. So it's goodbye from me, and until next week, take care. Goodbye.